Are archaeologists wasteful?
Should sites be preserved by not digging them?
And what happens to the remains of an archaeological site when it's time to pack up and go home?
The answers to those questions and another edition of Helen's Find on this episode of the Time Team Podcast.
Welcome to the Time Team Podcast with Martin Williams and Helen Geek. And this week, I'm answering your questions again.
Loads of people have been messaging through our Patreon page, which if you are a Time Team member, you can access to ask a question. Before we get into the questions, and by the way, Helen's find on the way too, where Helen's got an object, something really enticing that she's going to be explaining the story behind. Just want to say, if you haven't done it yet, do go and watch our Mary Rose episode, which we had such great fun making, me particularly, because I got to go up in that cherry picker. I was so close to the Mary Rose as well. I could have, which I didn't do, obviously, because I'm not silly, but I could have reached out and touched it. That is how close I was. And if you want to watch what that's all about, it's over on YouTube now. There is additional content. If you are a Time Team member, you can go and see a very specially recorded behind the scenes tour of that warehouse. If you've watched it, you know what I'm talking about. There's a warehouse where thousands more finds are stored. The public don't get to see it at all, but you do as a Time Team member, a very special tour on our Patreon, patreon.com/timeteamofficial. Another thing on the bulletin board, people have been asking when our Brancaster, our Branadunum episode is going to be coming out. So we made an episode from Brancaster following the geophysics work that they were doing there. That's all going to be made into an episode of Time Team that's going to go out on our YouTube channel. And people have been saying, when's it going to happen? Soon, in the next few months, is the answer. But if you go on to our Patreon, there is additional stuff there as well. So if you go on there right now, you can see sort of more stuff, more content that we filmed at Brancaster. So there's more information there. But do keep your eyes peeled, because that YouTube video is going to be coming in the next few months.
And that one is going to be a really extraordinary one. The more I think about what we have discovered just through doing the geophysics, the more extraordinary it is.
Let's get to the questions, shall we? And this first one comes from Sarah, who says, and it's a bit of a sad start here, we recently buried our much-loved guinea pig. Oh, dear, dear, dear. Poor old guinea pig. Sarah says, I found I couldn't cover her up without adding something that she loved. Parsley. Oh, very nice. It made me think about burial practices in Britain and how they change over time. I've enjoyed discovering through Time Team how grave goods can indicate the time period, status, and occupation of a person. But having attended some funerals recently, it's made me feel that we are now kept more at a distance from the body. Is there a point in time where we suddenly begin to see significantly fewer grave goods, maybe just a piece of jewellery worn as the body is professionally laid out? And does that point in time correspond with anything such as church influence or other social change? Helen, what are your thoughts?
Well, yes, Sarah, I agree. We are these days kept at more of a distance from the body. And I think that's because during the funeral, we concentrate on this closed coffin. The focus of a burial tends to be when the closed coffin is lowered into the grave. But in the early Anglo-Saxon period, that point where graves were really lavishly furnished, we think that what you were supposed to focus on during the funeral was more the grave tableau laid out in the bottom of the grave so that you could view it during the funeral. It was the body with its grave goods that you saw. Whereas now, if you put something into a coffin, well, you just have to have your memory of it because no one can see it during the funeral. So we've got no real evidence that this grave tableau, whether it's on a cremation pyre or in the bottom of an inhumation grave, we've got no real evidence that that was the thing that they were focusing on. We've got no descriptions of an early Anglo-Saxon funeral. I think it seems reasonable from the evidence that we do have that that theory should be a likely one. So given that we don't see all of these grave goods, why would we ever put one in? Well, the odd thing is that, strangely, these days we do seem to be beginning to include more and more grave goods. So people are putting in favourite clothes, say a football scarf or a favourite keepsake. Wedding rings are often in the grave with the dead person rather than being handed down to the next generation and so on. And I have a little private theory about this. People do say that grave goods are put there for the afterlife. That tends to be what people assume. Why do you have grave goods? It's for the afterlife. But weirdly, I feel that the less we believe in an afterlife, the more grave goods we put in. In the early Anglo-Saxon period, when we have quite small hints of evidence that they didn't have a very fully formed idea of whether there was a life after death, it's full of grave goods. And now that fewer and fewer people believe in a life everlasting, we're putting in more grave goods again. It's just a correlation. I can't work out really the causation, but that is my theory. But anyway, that's not really what you were asking about. So to focus back on the question properly, yes, there is a moment sometime around the end of the 7th century AD, so a couple of hundred years into the early Anglo-Saxon period, when they suddenly stop including grave goods. And there's huge and slightly vitriolic debate at the moment as to precisely when and, of course, also precisely why. But this is what I did my PhD on, so I feel I've got the right to suggest my own ideas. It doesn't seem, as far as I can see, to be linked to the arrival of Christianity. Christianity has been being adopted by various kingdoms in various parts of England all through the 7th century. And the last kingdom, Sussex, the Isle of Wight area, had been Christian for a couple of decades at least before grave goods stopped being used. And another thing that you don't see that you'd expect to see if it was to do with Christianity and conversion, you don't see that the kingdoms converted earlier, like, say, Kent, give up grave goods earlier. So it doesn't seem to work. This idea that the church comes along, says you shouldn't be using grave goods, and everybody stops. Anyway, we also have no evidence that the church was in any way interested in grave goods. It doesn't ban them at all. There's not even a hint of that. I think we have to look for something else that all the kingdoms were doing at the same time, and another reason why they might abandon grave goods. And I think it's actually not religion. It's politics. It's that they're all adopting kingship, and the kings are becoming stronger and stronger and stronger all the way through the 7th century. The other thing that they might have been doing, the kings, that is taxing. And maybe it's felt that the resources that would be going into grave goods are now resources that should go to the king. They should go to the king in the form of tax. I mean, we don't know, but I do think that that is one of the most interesting questions in archaeology. So thank you, Sarah, for raising it.
Yeah, thank you very much. And yeah, religion has a lot to answer for, doesn't it? But perhaps not this.
We don't know.
Let's move on to question two, which comes from Harold Wetzman, who says, "I'm not sure how to ask this and be polite at the same time," says Howard. Okay, well, careful, Howard. We're very sensitive. "This is something that I've been thinking about for years and I've done a little design work around it." Interesting. "Why do archaeologists waste so much data?" Howard goes on to say, "I know it sounds offensive and I don't mean to be, but I've always wondered why you aren't digging robotically in the dark with centimeter by centimeter multispectral analysis along with metagenomics at each point. I know one big reason is cost, and I think another is human convenience, but technology is moving to the point where you could do this in a single spot in the trench at least." I think Howard has sort of gone some way to answering his own question.
He has partly, yes. Cost is a big reason. Human convenience, yes. This is reminding me slightly of when automatic surveying came in and people said, why do we stand around twiddling our theodolites and taking readings and writing them down in a notebook when we can just press a button and it can do everything for us? And a lot of people said, well, because it takes out the human element. You've got to go in there and add your interpretation to it anyway. So why collect all this data robotically almost when you don't know if it's going to be the right kind of data? You know, you've got to have that human input, otherwise it's garbage in, garbage out. But I think there's also a couple of deeper things that Howard's asking here. I did have to go and look up metagenomics, I have to say, when I heard about this question. I think metagenomics is what I have been calling, and I know a lot of other people call, environmental DNA. You can analyse something like a pond sediment, and you can see from the DNA in there what fish have lived in the pond, amphibians, maybe like newts and frogs and things, whether cattle have pooed in the water or birds, etc., etc. So the meta part of it is that it's got lots and lots and lots of different genomes, and you can reconstruct the environment by reconstructing the animals that have lived there from the DNA. So yes, that's indeed possible. But what I think I'd say is that we don't always use it because it depends on what you want to know about. So we don't always want to know simply what kind of animals have been passing through. So we do in some ways waste a lot of data. I mean, we always have. We've always thrown our soil on the spoil heap without doing environmental DNA, without interrogating it for absolutely every tiny little thing that we could get out of it. But the question is, what would it tell us? It would maybe tell us that a bird has flown over and that in our soil there's various species of earthworm and woodlouse and so on, and maybe a fox scent mark there. But we're not looking for that. If what we're looking for is something like, you know, evidence of the Roman conquest or evidence of Bronze Age ritual, we wouldn't need that kind of data, so there would be no point in a way collecting it in the first place. I suppose you could design an experiment that would use the metagenomics. Maybe some people are, but that's not what most people are doing at the moment. Going on to the multispectral imaging, we're beginning to use that on Time Team sites, and I agree we don't do enough of it, but we're doing it at a kind of large scale, more like LIDAR. I don't know if anybody's doing it at the level of the individual trench, because all of this needs to be justified in this kind of cost-benefit analysis, because it is so costly, in both in terms of equipment and in terms of human time. So it's always a compromise between the effort that's put in and the destruction of the deposit that you're taking away and the information that you get out. Now, I imagine that what Howard might say is, well, if you're going to destroy that deposit, shouldn't you get every single tiny bit of data that you can out of it? And in theory, yes. But if you try and do that, you get a lot of pushback. So, for example, at Sutton Hoo, we looked very closely at the topsoil, and some people thought that was a pointless recording of data because they said, well, what on earth are you expecting to get by minutely recording the distribution of flints in the topsoil? Was it really going to mean anything? Well, you could argue it because we wanted to think about prehistoric activity on the site as well as everything else, because we could only look at that topsoil once. It was sensible to get that information out. But I bet loads of people thought that we should have been asking questions just about Anglo-Saxon activity, focusing our limited resources on that. And I bet they thought it wasn't necessary, because a lot of people did say, why are you doing this? And the answer is because we can only do it once and we want to get as much out of it as possible. But even at Sutton Hoo, we didn't go down to trench level thermal imaging and eDNA. I have to say, I'm pretty ignorant about eDNA. I don't even know if you can get it out of ordinary topsoil. All of the studies I've seen so far have been in wet sediments.
Well, I've heard about it for the first time literally just now.
Because you could do, there was something else that used to be fashionable. When I was at university, there was this new idea that you could carbon date a wall, believe it or not, by taking all of the mortar or the lime mortar that's in a wall and extracting charcoal from it, tiny, tiny flecks of charcoal that come from the lime-making process.
And then you could carbon date that.
Now, that's another example of how if you absolutely minutely work at it, you might be able to get another data point. But is it worth it? I mean, it depends on what you count. I mean, Howard says we're wasting data. That's true. Other people might say, well, at least we're not wasting money or we're not wasting time. It's a balance of all of these things.
It's sort of reminding me of having a blood test at the hospital. Mm. Let's say you go to your doctor and you're complaining of stomach pain or something, and they say, right, well, we're going to send you for a blood test. Mm. And you go and have a blood test. Well, if I'm giving you my blood, why can't you check it for absolutely anything that could possibly be wrong with me? But they won't. They'll check it for maybe two or three, four or five things that are associated or could be the reason for why I've got a poorly tummy or what, you know, whatever it might be. That surely is because of time and cost and the destructive nature of the test that they might be doing, where they might have to use a certain part of the sample of blood in order to do their test, which would mean that there was less left over to do all the other tests that they could possibly do. And so they're sort of doing the best with what they've got, including the fact that what they've also got is limited time and limited resources.
Yes, that's true. And the other thing about your blood test is that they can always come back to you for more blood. I know they have to make another hole in you to get it out, but it's essentially non-destructive. Whereas you can argue that when we dig away the whole of a grave fill, for instance, there is no grave fill left. It's all been disordered and put on the spoil heap, and that there might have been data in there. But often when we've done the work taking the samples down through grave fills, it reminds me slightly of picking apart the mounds at Sutton Hoo. We picked apart mound 2 in absolutely minute detail, took several years to do it, and the conclusion at the end was that the Anglo-Saxons had just heaped up a load of soil. There was no structure in there. Sometimes you ask the question and you discover that the answer was no, and you don't want to keep on asking the question and getting the answer, no, you needn't have bothered.
This is all very interesting, and I'm slightly annoyed that I brought blood tests into it, because now I'm feeling a little bit funny.
No, it doesn't worry me, that kind of thing. I'm completely sanguine, actually, which is an odd word.
I don't know why I brought it up. Oh, horrible. Shall we move on to Helen's Find? We've got two more questions to go, but before that, let's do Helen's Find. So this is where Helen introduces an object, an item, sometimes from the Portable Antiquity Scheme, often, in fact, from the Portable Antiquity Scheme, which is what Helen works for as a finds liaison officer, and just sort of talks a little bit about the story behind that object. And it's always very interesting. As usual, the link to the object, so you can go and look at it for yourself, is in the description of the podcast. What are we talking about this week?
Well, Martin, if you were feeling a bit queasy before, I'm afraid this is not going to do you any good, because it's an object with a rather horrid story attached to it. But let's start with the object first of all. Now, remember a couple of weeks ago, we were talking about shards versus sherds, the pronunciation, and I mentioned something that's spelt vervel, but it's pronounced varvel. Well, this week, I thought that we could look at a varvel in detail so you know what they're all about. So I've chosen this one. It's made from silver, as they usually are, and I recorded it a couple of years ago, and it's a very memorable one. In shape, it's a small ring with a shield-shaped tab below, and the whole thing, the ring and the tab, function as kind of labels or name tags for hawks or falcons, you know, birds of prey used in hawking. So if you're a rich person and you've got a very favourite and maybe rather valuable hawk, you might want to put your name on it so that if you lose it, it gets returned to you. And my theory is that if you make this label very shiny and smart looking, whoever finds it won't keep it. They'll return it to you because they might think they'll get a reward. So that is the benefit of that. And it also weighs less than a gram, so it won't weigh your bird down. So the ring is used to fix it to the leg of the bird. This one has got a picture of a horse's head on one side.
Yes, that's so detailed, isn't it? I'll just describe it as well. Imagine shape-wise, obviously these are really, really tiny things, but what, about a centimetre, 2 centimetres tall? But shape-wise, imagine a shield. So that's the shape you've got at the bottom, and that's got this etched image of a horse in it, and then above that you've got the ring, the metal ring, which is basically almost the same size again as this shield on top of it. So that's the kind of shape you can imagine in your mind, but then it's really, 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 really tiny.
So you've got the picture of the horse's head on that one side of the really tiny thing, and the name C. Hyam in capital letters on the other. And the fact that it is shield-shaped means that it's probably heraldic. If you look through heraldic designs, you can see that a horse's head appears on the arms of the Hyam family. So that ties the two sides together. We're pretty definite that it's this Hyam family that have a horse's head in their arms. Who is C. Hyam? Well, I think he is actually the most famous member of the Hyam family, Sir Clement Hyam, and he lived at Barrow Hall in Suffolk, and that's only a few miles west of where I live. So he's quite local. Oh. He was quite local. He died.
Local boy done good.
Yeah, well, no. Local boy done successful.
Done a bit bad.
Yes. Local boy done bad, definitely. But you might want to know when he was living. Well, he died in 1571, and it seems he was aged in his mid-70s. So if it is his, it would date historically to about, say, 1520 to 1570. And that's quite right for the style of the lettering and the engraving and all that kind of stuff. So that's another piece of evidence that it is his, is the right date. Now, I said local boy done bad. I mean, he was a famously nasty man.
Oh, dear.
He was born just before the turn of the 15th and 16th centuries in Suffolk, and he trained as a lawyer in London. And then when he was in his early 30s, he became the bailiff of the Abbey of Bury St Edmunds. Now, bailiff, that was a pretty responsible job because it was the kind of land agent and lawyer and everything all rolled into one. The kind of top lay person who would act on behalf of the monks, the abbot and so on in places that they couldn't act. Bury St Edmunds Abbey, it wasn't just his local abbey and my local abbey, it was arguably the biggest and richest monastery in the whole country because it had the shrine of St Edmund, who was the previous, before St George, patron saint of the English. That was in 1528, and just 5 years later, Henry VIII divorced Catherine of Aragon to marry Anne Boleyn, and he obviously took possession of all the monasteries while he was setting himself up as the head of the Church of England. Bury Abbey was dissolved in 1539, and at that point, Clement Higham would have been out of work. So he got through the next 10 or 15 years, quite quietly, it seems, as a lawyer in London at Lincoln's Inn and as a magistrate in Suffolk. But he seems to have been working behind the scenes on the Catholic side, because as soon as the next Protestant king, that's Henry's son Edward, died in 1553, Higham was one of the great men of the area that was summoned by Mary Tudor as being part of the faction that would help put her on the throne. So you know how there was the little difficulty around Lady Jane Grey, that she was put on the throne as the Protestant candidate, and Mary swept in with her supporters, including Clement Higham, and managed to remove Jane from the throne after 9 days and become queen herself as the Catholic Queen Mary. He was in prime position as a loyal Catholic, and also, I mean, this is where the nastiness comes in, also as a lawyer. So he was really heavily involved in the persecution of Protestants. And of course, that's the period of the Protestant martyrs. He was really heavily involved in a lot of the executions. Stories were written down about him in Fox's Book of Martyrs. I am going to tell you one of the stories connected with Clement Higham. The story comes from 1558, which is close to the end of Mary's reign. And there was a Suffolk woman called Alice Driver from the village of Grunsborough, which is on the way from me to Sutton Hoo. She had got hold of a Protestant Bible, so that's a Bible in English, and she had been reading it, and she'd stopped attending church because she felt that the Catholic Mass was wrong, that it was idolatrous, that it was sinful. So she'd stopped going to church, which was illegal. So she had heard that she was being investigated for non-attendance at church, and she'd gone into hiding. But unfortunately, she was found, she was captured, she was taken for trial at Bury St Edmunds, and the judge in that trial was Sir Clement Higham. Alice Driver would have known that Clement Higham had already ordered several Protestants to be burnt at the stake. He was famous for his executions and torturings of Protestants. But still, Alice bravely stood her ground. The trial is detailed in Fox's Book of Martyrs, and you can see her arguments and her strength of character. Higham ordered at this point that her ears be cut off.
Oh.
And that was done immediately, straight away.
Oh.
Yes, really,
why?
Really.
Why?
Yes, you may ask why. I'm in order to cow her, I think, in order to make her realise that he was the one with power here. So he then sent her off for a further interrogation at Ipswich, and we've got all the details of that as well in the Book of Martyrs. And rather inevitably, she was condemned to death and she was burnt at the stake on the 4th of November, 1558. Now, the date is important.
I am really going off this guy.
Well, it gets worse, I'm afraid, because 4th of November, 1558, at that point, Higham was burning many, many people to death. And he must have known at the same time that Queen Mary was dying. He also must have known that after she died, we would have the Protestant Queen Elizabeth on the throne and those persecutions would immediately stop. It's almost as if he was in a hurry to get as many people executed as he could. And Mary, in fact, died on the 17th of November. So that's less than a fortnight after Alice Driver was killed. There are a lot of stories like that about Sir Clement Higham. It's this kind of thing that makes you feel really glad that we live in modern times. And in a way, I feel a bit bad about drawing him to people's attention. He should, by rights, be, in a way, forgotten. But then you see, people like Alice Driver shouldn't be forgotten. She died for her strongly held beliefs and for the fact that she wasn't prepared to back down in the face of this inevitable thing that was going to happen to her. She struck a blow for free speech, if you like. And I feel at this point that we've rather got off the subject of hawking rings of varvels.
Well, no, but in a wonderful way. It was a fantastic story.
Yes, because the point of this is that you can see an object and it can take you into all of these incredible stories about life and in fact, death in the past. That's what archaeology is so good for. Anybody can tell this story, but we've got an object that we can hang it on and we can say, look, this actually belonged to him. This is a tangible reminder of what he did.
Yeah, what a git. Hey?
Yes. Yes. Oh, and you know, one of the things that kind of makes it worse in a way, I mean, as if anything could make it worse, but you might wonder what happened to Clement Higham after Queen Elizabeth came to the throne. You know, did he receive the same kind of punishment? And the answer is no, he didn't. He quietly resigned all of his offices and all of his honours, and he went home to Suffolk, and he carried on working as a magistrate, had a nice, pleasant, quiet life throughout his 60s and 70s until he quietly died in his bed, which doesn't seem quite right, does it?
No, it doesn't seem fair at all. Well, Sir Clement Higham, what a horrible man. Anyway, an interesting story nonetheless, and if you want to see that object, then do make sure you have a little look in the description of this podcast, and there's a link to it there.
You're listening to the Time Team podcast with Martin Williams and Helen Geek, and this week I am answering your questions.
If you want to ask a question, then you need to be a Time Team member. Very, very easy to do that. The details are over on Patreon for you. So you go to patreon.com/timeteamofficial and there's a little chats section and you can add your comment, your message, your question, and we will ask it in a future edition of the podcast. Robert has got in touch and Robert's been watching or listening to our Brancaster podcast and says in the Brancaster podcast, Francis Pryor touched on leaving large parts of sites untouched with the idea future advances will help learn more than we could know now. I wonder, though, how it works for sites where a small exploratory trench is dug only to find preservation is not what was thought or hoped. While buried stone would last nearly forever, things like metal are more subject to the environment. Have you been on or know of a site where an exploratory trench has shown artifacts are deteriorating faster than expected, where if it's not dug completely, it'll be lost? If so, how's that decided and who has to make that decision? Well, we touched on that at Brancaster. We also touched on it in our conversation about the Mary Rose as well, and whether or not that should have been raised and the benefits and drawbacks of doing that. And it's a question that I know is always on the minds of archaeologists.
Yes, and one of the best examples is actually Francis's own site at Flag Fen, because that's a site of waterlogged wood which has been pretty much perfectly preserved since the Bronze Age. But now, because first of all, drainage, since the agricultural revolution, the fens have been drained, and then in the present century to or 20th century and 21st century to climate change, because of this it's drying out and it's now really seriously at risk. And it's got that in common with Star Car, which is an amazing waterlogged Mesolithic site in Yorkshire, and there they did put in some exploratory trenches to see how it was getting on and realised that largely due to climate change it is drying out at a ferocious rate, and that work needs to be done to rescue it before it becomes destroyed. Asking about who makes those decisions, well, that's a really interesting question. Somebody has got to decide that they are going to take it on. You have to try to get funding. Obviously, if it's a nationally significant site, then Historic England is the place to go to. But it is never easy. You're having to balance all these waterlogged wood sites that are drying out with other sites that are vulnerable to climate change, things like sites where the coast is eroding. Huge lengths of coast are eroding. We've got places like Covehithe Church in Suffolk. That's an ideal opportunity to excavate an entire parish church. How often do those come along? Because within the next few decades, that is going to be eroded away and go over the cliff, like happened to the church at Dunwich, quite famously. We're going to lose an awful lot of sites to coastal erosion. We're already losing loads to drying out. Yeah, who makes the decisions? They can't all be saved. It is very difficult.
Which is why we need people like Robert being time team members, because Robert is helping to fund archaeology, which, you know, may well go on to sort of rescue the archaeology of a particular site before it is lost. And we do plenty of that.
Yes, time team did some work at Dunwich. Ooh, what would that have been? About 2011, 2012, something like that. Sometimes there is no option but to call in people like time team because nobody else can be found to fund it. And so that's where Patreons come in.
Absolutely, it is. Final question comes from Valerie, who says, when, and this is, I suppose, a kind of follow-on question in a way, when time team depart from a site, what happens to the archaeology? For instance, if a mosaic is found damaged by modern ploughing, is it left in the ground and soil replaced at the end of the dig so it may be damaged by future ploughing? So I suppose, yes, so we come along and the archaeologists, they dig a trench, they discover this amazing mosaic. Then what do you do? Do you just cover it over knowing that it's going to be damaged by ploughing in the future? Or do you try and extract it, but then what do you do with it? Again, it's just, it's more questions, isn't it? Yeah. Questions always raise questions, raise questions.
Yes, and when it comes down to it, well, it is a very difficult question. You can't save everything and you have to prioritise. So when we finish an archaeological site, we obviously have almost never taken every single bit of it away. We haven't had total excavation. You would do in a site that's being done in advance of development, but for something like a time team site, for a research site, you don't. So we have to replace the soil, we have to reinstate the site, and then we can start a conversation with the farmer. But essentially, it's ultimately the job of the landowner, because they own the land and the crops, obviously, but they also own the archaeology. I know that seems crazy, because in a way it's all of ours. Oh, it's an asset that belongs to everybody. The past belongs to all of us, but legally it belongs to the landowner.
Yeah, well, it's in their field, isn't it? They've bought it, they've paid for it. Yeah.
Yes, in a sense, yes. If they buy a field, they buy the field with everything down to the centre of the earth, as far as I understand it, yes.
It's a lot of real estate.
Yes. But you might think, well, what about if the site's got some kind of statutory protection? Because our legal system does recognise the fact that the past does in some sense belong to all of us, so that very important sites are protected by the state. So in the UK, that would be putting it on the schedule of ancient monuments, so it become a scheduled monument. But contrary to what a lot of people think, that doesn't prevent a landowner carrying on ploughing it. There's a system called a class consent. And the reason it's called a consent is because if you've got a scheduled monument on your land, you have to get scheduled monument consent to do anything that would damage it. But you can get a class consent, which says that you can carry on doing the class of activity that you've been doing before it was scheduled. So if you have been ploughing it before it was scheduled, you can carry on ploughing it after it's been scheduled, because it's not thought right that you should stop a farmer doing something just because the state has decided that it's important. It, almost in a way, it's like a lot of these sites are discovered because they're ploughed up, and we want to encourage the farmers to report that. So we don't want to punish them by saying, and now you've reported it, now you've done the right thing, we're going to stop you ploughing it. It's a really difficult balance between the rights of the farmer and the landowner, trying to persuade the farmer to do the right thing, trying not to punish them for doing the right thing, and also trying to protect the site. It is one of the knottiest problems, and there have been so many conferences and research projects to find out what we can do. Will minimum tilling, you know, no-till agriculture, would that help? Can farmers be persuaded to do it because you can't force them? Can we do different kinds of crops? Can we pay them to revert it to pasture so that it doesn't get ploughed anymore? In the end, it's often the subsidy regime, a bit like, you know, you tax things like alcohol and cigarettes because you want to persuade people not to use them. Well, you can subsidise a farmer in a way that will encourage them to protect their archaeology. But it isn't easy at all because the land is being used for so many things. We've got to carry on feeding ourselves, haven't we?
We do. It is such a difficult one. And I wonder that we are maybe sort of just about striking the right balance. It kind of feels to me that the system that we have at the moment probably is just about right. I guess it doesn't please everyone, but then maybe that's what compromise is all about.
Yeah, I think what it is it doesn't please anybody.
Yeah,
that's probably just about right. Yes. Everybody's a bit annoyed.
Yeah, but everybody's equally thoroughly annoyed. Angry about it, which means that everybody's, you know, we're all in the same place. Valerie, a brilliant question. We've got to finish them here because we're pretty much out of time. If you do want to ask a question on a future edition of the podcast, then very, very easy to do that. You just become a Time Team member. Patreon.com/Time Team Official. If you want to know a little bit more about Time Team, by the way, I keep forgetting to mention this, and it's really, really worth knowing about if you don't already. Very regularly, we put out a mailer as an email that goes around that tells you loads about what Time Team is up to, the digs that we've been doing, the videos that you can watch. You can learn so much more about it. If you just go to our website, which is timeteamdigital.com, you can sign up there to receive the email, and very, very worth doing it, is it? So go and have a look at that, timeteamdigital.com. Next week, Stuart Ainsworth is coming back on the podcast. You wait ages for Stuart Ainsworth to appear, and then he appears on a load of episodes in very close succession. But we're delighted. He's sort of, he's putting on his Constable Ainsworth hat, because Stuart is doing some work with the police at the moment, and he's going to be talking about how skills from archaeology can help tackle heritage crime, which is something he's really passionate about and he's been doing an awful lot of work on. It is fascinating as well. So Stuart's going to be on with a copper to talk all about that.
I think one day he's going to end up a special constable, isn't he? He's going to be a voluntary policeman going around sniffing out heritage criminals, sadly, it is something that is becoming more and more prevalent, or at any rate, we're becoming more and more informed about it. So I think that's going to be a really important and really interesting episode.
Yeah, and that is going to be next week. So I hope you can join us for that. Stuart with his truncheon, and me and Helen on the next edition of the Time Team podcast.
Bye-bye. An image.